I want you to picture a scenario. It is the dead of winter. We're talking February, freezing rain. The wind is just howling against the windows. And inside your house,
Just silence.
absolute heavy silence. The power has been out for like 11 hours. Your refrigerator is slowly turning into a room temperature cupboard. The boiler controls are dead. So the house is just dropping toward freezing.
And the Wi-Fi is long gone.
Oh, yeah, the Wi-Fi is gone, and you are wandering around with a dying flashlight, frantically looking for an extension cord to hook up a portable generator that, let's be honest, is way too small to actually run the furnace and the fridge at the same time.
That is a very specific and very stressful nightmare scenario. But I think for a lot of homeowners, specifically those out in the suburbs or in rural areas, it's a really familiar one.
It is exactly the nightmare scenario that sparked the journey we are covering today. We're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating source titled My Whole House Generator DIY Journey. And look, this isn't just about going to a big box store, pointing at a shiny machine, and hoping for the best.
Right. Yeah.
This is about the deep technical rabbit hole of sizing, wiring, and testing a proper backup system for your home.
And what really stands out about this deep dive is that it moves way past the marketing brochures. I mean, the author of our source material actually did the math and made the mistakes so that we don't have to. The mission here is to help you avoid those expensive blunders, like misunderstanding your service amperage or undersizing your wires, and to really help you build a system that is safe, reliable, and smart, rather than just buying the biggest, loudest machine you can find.
I am definitely ready for some light bulb moments, pun absolutely intended. But where do we even begin? Because if I'm that guy with the flashlight, I'm just thinking, I need power. I'm not thinking I need to calculate amperage.
Right. Well, we have to start where most people get tripped up. It's the great sizing misconception, and this is the trap the author almost fell into right out of the gate.
Oh, the monster generator trap.
Exactly. They looked at their electrical panel, saw a big sticker that said 200 amps, and thought, okay, I have a 200 amp service, so to back up my house, I must need a 200 amp generator.
Which, to be fair, sounds completely logical. If your bucket is 200 amps big, you want a 200 amp hose to fill it.
It makes total sense until you actually run the numbers.
Right, and they actually did the math on this in the source material. They used the basic power formula, which is power equals voltage times current. So 240 volts times 200 amps equals 48,000 watts or 48 kilowatts.
Which is massive.
Yeah, they started looking at pricing for 48 kilowatt generators, and I think they almost had a heart attack. I mean, we're talking industrial equipment prices at that point.
And that is exactly where the misunderstanding lies. You see, a 200 amp service rating is just the maximum capacity of your panel. It is the absolute ceiling before the main breaker trips to prevent the wires inside your walls from melting.
It's a safety limit, not a daily target.
Precisely. It does not mean your house is actually pulling 48 kilowatts of power at any given time. In fact, most homes never come anywhere close to that, even with every single light on and the TV blaring.
So if you don't need to match the panel rating, how do you actually figure out what you need? Because you definitely don't want to guess low and end up sitting in the dark again.
You have to do what the author calls a load audit. This is your reality check. You stop looking at the service rating on the box and start looking at what you actually use. The author suggests breaking your appliances down into three specific buckets.
Oh, right. The critical, comfort, and luxury buckets. I love this categorization. So, critical is the stuff that absolutely must run. We're talking the fridge, the freezer, the boiler or furnace controls, the sump pump, because nobody wants a flooded basement on top of a power outage.
And the internet router.
Oh, absolutely critical. Got to have the Wi-Fi.
Then you have comfort. These are the nice to haves. The microwave, the washing machine, maybe the central AC if it's the middle of summer. And finally, you have luxury or high demand. These are the major energy hogs that you usually just keep off during an outage. Things like the electric water heater, the electric oven, or, the sauna.
Wait, people have saunas.
Some do. But the real point is, once the author laid all this out in a spreadsheet, they realized something huge. You do not need to power everything simultaneously. When marketing says whole house, what it usually implies is whole house with smart prioritization. By just realizing you can choose not to run the electric oven while the AC is cranking, you literally save thousands of dollars on the generator size.
So let's get into the actual numbers on that. The source material gives a practical generator sizing guide. I found this fascinating because it completely defies that bigger is better logic. If you have 100 amp service, you don't automatically need 24 kilowatts.
No, not at all. The data shows that a home with 100 amp service can often run very comfortably on just 12 to 18 kilowatts, provided those loads are managed. I mean, if you have gas heat and a gas water heater, your electrical demand is actually pretty low.
And even for the 200 amp service, the big one, the author found you don't need that monster 48 kilowatt unit.
Right. A 200 amp home often works perfectly well with 20 to 30 kilowatts. The caveat, of course, is that you have to shed the heavy loads. If you have an EV charger or a massive electric range, you can't just run those willy-nilly during a blackout. But if you manage those, you don't need to build a power plant in your backyard.
However, there is a twist in the math here. It's not just about the running watts the power a device uses while it's just humming along. It's about the startup problem.
Yes, this is critical. We call this inrush current, or surge. Physics dictates that an object at rest wants to stay at rest. Motors are greedy. When they first wake up, they demand a massive spike of power just to get moving.
The source uses the refrigerator as an example for this. It runs on maybe 200 to 400 watts, which is nothing. But when that compressor actually kicks on, it spikes to 800 or even 1200 watts.
And that's just a small example. Look at a sump pump. It might run at 800 watts, but it can surge to 4000 watts on a startup. If your generator is sized only for the running watts, the second that sump pump kicks on, boom, the generator stalls so the voltage collapses.
And central AC is the absolute biggest offender here.
Oh, massive. A 5-ton unit can pull 12,000 watts or more just to start. If you don't account for that surge, your generator might just shut down to protect itself.
So you really have to size for the surge, not just the steady hum. And this brings up a lifestyle point the author makes, which I thought was really smart. A bigger generator doesn't just cost more upfront. It drinks way more fuel.
That's the major trade-off. A massive generator that is just idling is incredibly inefficient. It burns through your propane or natural gas supply much, much faster. Mm. The author consciously chose what they called a realistic outage lifestyle.
Right.
They decided they wanted heat, the fridge, internet, and the pumps. They were perfectly okay with not roasting a 20-pound turkey in the electric oven during a blackout. And that single decision made the whole system efficient and affordable.
Well, let's pivot and talk about the wiring, because this is where the DIY part of the title gets a little complicated. The author makes a very strong point here. They did all the planning and all the math themselves, but they hired a pro for the final hookup.
A very wise decision. Generator installation touches on life safety, code compliance, and utility interconnection. You really do not want to mess around with backfeeding the grid.
Backfeeding, that's when you accidentally send power out of your house and onto the dead power lines in the street, right?
Exactly. And if there is a lineman working on those lines down the street trying to restore power, you kill him. It is strictly illegal and extremely dangerous. That final connection needs to be done by a licensed electrician.
But the author did dive deep into the wire sizing before handing it off. And this is a question I see online constantly, people asking, what size wire do I need for a 100-amp generator?
It's the classic it depends answer, but the source does give us some solid ground rules. It depends heavily on the conductor material. Copper conducts better than aluminum, so you can use a thinner wire if you go with copper.
The general rule of thumb they mentioned was roughly number 3 AWG for copper or number 1 AWG for aluminum. But the author almost made a huge mistake here. They were looking at the ampacity, like how much current the wire can technically handle, but they completely ignored the distance.
Ah, yes. The run length mistake. This is physics coming back to bite you again. All wire has resistance. If you push electricity through a long wire, you lose some of that pressure along the way. We call that voltage drop.
In this case, the author moved the generator location. They wanted it further away from the house so they wouldn't hear the engine noise and to keep the exhaust fumes safely away. But doing that meant a much longer cable run. I think it was about 60 feet.
Exactly. And if they had stuck with the original wire size over that longer distance, the voltage drop would have been too high. Think of it like a garden hose. If you have a really long, skinny hose, the water just sort of trickles out at the very end.
Right.
When a heavy motor like the AC or that sump pump tried to start, the voltage would dip and the equipment could stall or even be permanently damaged.
It's like trying to drink a really thick milkshake through a super long, skinny straw. You just can't get the flow you need.
That is actually a surprisingly accurate analogy. You need a wider straw, meaning thicker wire, to get the flow you need over that distance without losing the pressure.
And this brings up placement strategy. It turns out where you put the generator isn't just about how it looks in your yard. It dictates everything from cable length and trenching costs to gas line routing.
It's a giant puzzle. You have to balance electrical efficiency, fuel access, and maintenance access. You need to be able to actually get to the thing to change the oil, after all. And critically, you need to keep the exhaust far away from windows and vents. Carbon monoxide is no joke.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting for the tech geeks listening. The source material spends some time on system configuration, specifically the confusion between single-phase and three-phase power.
This is a vital distinction to make. Most residential homes in North America are single-phase. You basically have two hot lines and a neutral. But commercial buildings often use three-phase.
And the author warns that buying a three-phase generator, maybe you see a surplus unit from an industrial auction online for a single-phase house, is a total disaster. How do you even check what you have?
The easiest way is to just look at your main breaker or the label on your panel. It will usually say 100-1240V one-phase. Or you can count the service conductors coming in. If you see three main wires plus a neutral, that might be three-phase. But usually you'll just see two lines in a neutral for a home. Or, honestly, just check your utility bill.
Simple enough. But then the author does some napkin math that I found pretty surprising regarding current and voltage. They ask, how much current is 700 watts?
This is Ohm's law in action. Power equals voltage times current. So if you have 700 watts running at 240 volts, you're pulling about 3 amps. But if you take that exact same 700 watts and run it at 120 volts...
it jumps to almost 6 amps.
Almost double. And this matters immensely when you are balancing loads on your generator. Your panel has two legs, or phases. You want to spread your 120-volt appliances, the lights, the microwave, the TV, evenly across both legs.
Wait, so if I put all my lights in the fridge on the left side of the panel and nothing on the right side?
Your generator is going to be very unhappy. It's like trying to ride a bike with only one pedal. You need to balance the load so the alternator runs smoothly. That 700-watt calculation is the key to understanding how to physically distribute your appliances in the breaker box.
And then there is the power factor twist.
Right. If you have a load with a low power factor, like certain cheap motors or electronics, they actually draw more current than the raw wattage suggests. It's inefficient. So your 700 watts might actually be pulling the equivalent current of a much higher wattage load. It's basically a hidden tax on your generator's capacity.
Moving on to the hardware itself, the author chose an automatic transfer switch, or ATS, over a manual interlock.
An interlock is definitely cheaper. It's really just a sliding metal plate on your panel that physically forces you to turn off the main breaker before you can turn on the generator breaker. But it requires you to be there, hold a flashlight, and manually flip the switches. And ATS does it all for you. The utility power goes out, the switch senses the drop, starts the generator, warms it up, and moves the load over automatically.
The author called it family-friendly.
Which is a completely valid metric. If you aren't home, maybe you're traveling for work, can your partner or your kids safely restore the power? With an ATS, they don't have to do a single thing. The robot handles it.
But there was a real gotcha mentioned here, too. The bonding issue.
This is a safety detail that DIRs very often miss, and it's dangerous. It's about the neutral and ground wires. In your main panel, the neutral and ground are connected. They're bonded together. But your new generator also has a neutral and ground.
So if both of them are bonded, you have a loop.
Correct. You create a parallel path for current to flow on the ground wire, which can actually energize the metal frame of the generator, or even your appliances. If you touch the generator while it's running, you could get a serious shock.
Yikes.
Yeah. If your ATS swishes the neutral wire, you handle the bonding one way. If it's a solid neutral, you handle it another. If you get this wrong, you can create dangerous ground loops or prevent your safety breakers from tripping during a fault. This is exactly why you hired the electrician for that final check.
Now, I want to talk about copper. The author went down a bit of a rabbit hole wondering, how much copper is actually in a generator? Because they heard old-timers say heavy generators are always better.
It's a fair question. Copper is expensive, and heavy generators just feel more robust.
But the answer they found is that there is no fixed amount.
No. It depends entirely on the alternator design and efficiency class. And the takeaway here is really important. Don't buy a generator based on its weight or its scrap value thinking. More copper doesn't automatically mean a better machine.
So what should we actually look for when comparing units?
You want to look at total harmonic distortion, or THD.
Dirty power.
Exactly. Think of electricity like a sound wave. You want a pure, clean, smooth note. A cheap generator produces a jagged, distorted wave. That's high THD. Now, your basic toaster doesn't care about dirty power, but your smart fridge, your LED dimmer switches, your computer, they absolutely hate it.
So if I buy a cheap high THD generator, I might actually blow up my expensive electronics.
Potentially, yes. Or they just won't function at all. You really want a unit with less than 5% PhD for modern homes. A heavy generator with bad voltage regulation is far worse than a lighter, smarter one that produces clean power.
Okay, let's fast forward to the moment of truth. The system is installed, the wiring is checked by the pro, it's time for the first test.
The author describes this moment perfectly. The utility power is cut, the generator starts up, the ATS clicks over with that heavy thud, and the lights come on. Success. Everyone is high-fiving.
And then a family member turns on a high-demand appliance. I think they said it was the microwave right at the exact second the sump pump kicked in.
And the lights dim. The engine groans. The dip.
Was that a failure of the design?
No, not at all. It was a lesson. It proved that theoretical math on a spreadsheet differs from actual human behavior. The generator was sized perfectly correctly for the average running load, but not for every single load happening at the exact same millisecond.
This led to the creation of what they call outage load etiquette. I love this idea so much.
It's remarkably low-tech, but highly effective. The author literally just made a list for the family. Do not run the microwave while the sump pump is cycling. Do not wash clothes while the AC is trying to start.
It's basically realizing that you are now your own local power company. You have to manage the grid.
Exactly. Whole house marketing makes us think we can live seamlessly like nothing happened. But a truly resilient system requires just a little bit of user participation. It verified that the system works best when those comfort loads are actively managed by the people living in the house.
Speaking of the equipment itself, the author looked at all the big names. Generac, Kohler, Cummins, Champion.
And this brings up a crucial insight from the source. On paper, the spec sheets often look very similar. A 20-kilowatt unit is a 20-kilowatt unit.
So what was the deciding factor for them?
Local support.
Dealer support.
Yes. The author realized that the best generator in the world is just a giant metal paperweight if it breaks during a regional ice storm, and the nearest certified technician is 3 states away. You buy the brand that has a guy with a truck and spare parts right in your town.
That is such practical, grounded advice. It's not about the glossy brochure. It's about who answers the phone at 2 a.m. when it's freezing outside.
Precisely.
So we have gone from a freezing house with a dying flashlight to a fully functional smart backup system. Let's recap the key lessons for anyone listening who is maybe eyeing that generator aisle at the hardware store.
First and foremost, service size does not equal generator size.
Yeah.
Just because you have a 200-amp panel doesn't mean you need a massive 200-amp generator.
Lesson two is to do the load audit. Don't just guess your wattage. Write it down. Separate the critical loads from the luxury loads.
Lesson three touches on wire sizing. It's not just about the amps. It's about the distance of the run. You have to watch out for voltage drop, or your heavy motors will stall and burn out.
And finally, real-world testing. You have to simulate the outage and see what actually happens when the microwave and the AC fight for power at the same time.
And establish that outage etiquette. It costs absolutely nothing, and it saves the whole system from overloading.
This has been a really fascinating look into what it actually takes to keep the lights on. It's so much more than just plugging in a machine and walking away.
It really is. It turns the homeowner from a passive consumer of electricity into an active participant in their own power stability.
I want to leave you with a thought to mull over. We tend to think of our homes as these static boxes where we just plug things into the wall and they magically work. But this deep dive really showed us that a home is a dynamic living system. Loads are constantly spiking and dropping. Motors are surging. Currents are flowing all around us.
That's a great perspective to have.
Yeah.
It's a complex machine that we live inside of.
So if the power went out right now at this exact second, do you know which of your luxuries are secretly essential? And maybe more importantly, which of your essentials are actually luxuries you could live without to save yourself thousands of dollars on a generator?
That is the $1 million question.
Ooh.
Or at least the $10,000 question.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Stay warm, keep the lights on, and we'll see you next time.